Mary Carlson, and place of birth was Milo, Maine, and the date of birth is February 16, 1944.
This is a really interesting story, considering that I was with Extension for 34 years. I married a Vermonter in 1966, and he had been drafted in the Army and was stationed in Kansas for about 10 months and went overseas to Vietnam. That was the whole pattern at the time. He got out of the Army in October of 1967. We had planned to settle in Maine. We had no plans to come to Vermont at all. And he was scheduled to get out of the Army about November of 1967, but his mother died very suddenly here in Starksboro, and so he actually was taken right out of the field in Vietnam and came home, and so he was out. Well, his stepfather and three children still in school were at the house in Starksboro, and they were all pretty shaken about this unexpected death of the wife and mother. So my husband at the time, we decided that we would stay in Vermont for a little while till the family got settled. And Tom Carlson was my husband, and he was a professional cook, and he got a job for Saga Food Service, which was the food service at the University of Vermont at the time. I needed a job in order for us to be able to have our own apartment. And my degree from the University of Maine was a Bachelor of Arts degree in social work. And so I needed to find a job. And I went in December of 1967 to the Vermont Department of Employment Security in Burlington and put in an application for a job. And a couple of days later, I got a call and an opportunity to go for an interview with University of Vermont Extension Service, and it was a job that was called a program assistant, and it was half time with home economics and half time with the 4-H program. And I didn't know too much about this job. I just knew I needed a job. And I had had no 4-H experience. I had no experience whatsoever with the Extension Service. The secret here is that the night before my interview at my father-in-law's house, I looked up in the Book of Knowledge, the Encyclopedia Book of Knowledge, the definition or what was cooperative extension. And that was how I found out what cooperative extension was. And the next day I went into my interview, and that was all the knowledge I had about Extension Service. The reason that they were interested in me up until that time, if you were working with extension, your degrees were pretty much in home economics or agriculture or education. But that was at the time of the War on Poverty. And it even was before the Expanded Food and Nutrition Program, the EFNET program. But they were beginning some programs of working with low-income people in their homes and teaching them. And so there was an extension educator program, which was even before FNEP, and they were looking for people with that kind of background. And so my social work background came right in. Otherwise, I would not have been a line on a page. That was just exactly what they were looking for. And the other thing was, and this is not exactly off the record, but although there were the equal employment opportunity laws at that time, it was still pretty much a time when, in my opinion, you got, which I learned later, you got jobs with Extension Service if you had been a 4-H'er or if you knew somebody. It was still pretty internal. And when I later figured out I had come in off the street and gotten this job, I thought, how did this happen? So, as my life has gone on since then, I've thought, well, this was really meant to be. And so, since they knew my husband was right out of the Army, they wanted to know, would I make a commitment to being there for a couple of years? Yeah, well, it landed to be more than a couple of years. And so my work was in the home economics division, was in working with low-income people. And actually, I started working with senior citizens who were living alone and needed to have some education around financial management and resources that were available. And I supervised a core of elders who were hired with a special grant to work one-on-one with people. So that was how that worked out, and then later I went on to work with the Extension Homemakers and be their advisor. So that was where the home ec part fit in. I didn't really need to have a home economics background to do those kinds of tasks. And then the other 50% was with the 4-H Youth Development Program, which eventually I went into working full-time with that. And again, that was working with volunteers and doing volunteer training and with the teens and that kind of thing. So that was how it came to be. Of course, there were not so many people in the marketplace, in the work marketplace at that time. Later on, I would look back at that and say, how in the world did you ever get this job? Because we would do such intensive interview processes, background processes in hiring people later on. But it apparently fit. I mean, the other joke was, the woman who, Doris Steele, who was the home economics program leader, had laryngitis that day of my interview. I came to appreciate that much more later on because she and the 4-H, John Merchant and Polly Rowe, who were the 4-H people, didn't have the most compatible relationship. There was always a competition there. So later on when I figured out how interesting it was that Doris had laryngitis. Took me a while to appreciate that. I was in a corner of the state 4-H office. The person who was my secretary, Lee Dopp, whom we called Doppy, was a man. That was in 1968. My secretary for several years was a man. He was not happy about having another person to be secretary for. He did not have a telephone on his desk. He refused to answer the telephone. And he was working with a manual typewriter. And everybody else was using electric typewriters. So the thing about this is, I didn't exactly have the most welcoming atmosphere in terms of support staff. But we turned out to be really good friends. And again, it was very unusual to have a male secretary. When the time came that I was working only with 4-H Youth Development, I went on to a faculty position. It was helpful to me in that my job could be focused in one arena, in the 4-H Youth Development arena, and I had more control over what I did. I never ever had a supervisory role on a permanent basis, a supervisory role with the staff. But I always had a role of educational support and responsibility for much of the international program and the teen program and the leadership development program. And for some people, some people might have felt lesser, I guess I would say, if they didn't have that supervisory role. But I never felt that way. It gave me the flexibility to have more control over what I did. I didn't have to write annual Fed reports. I didn't have to get into all of that stuff. I could pretty much focus on staff development and volunteer development and programs to do that, which was wonderful for my mental health. And also, I never was really in the position of being the bad guy. There is some value to being the next guy down to the top person. That's something that I really learned through this experience. It worked out really, really well. Some of the changes that happened over those years were certainly the changes that technology brought. And I actually retired in 2002 before the huge explosion of technology. But that meant fewer support staff, but we actually needed fewer support staff. I think I, in my opinion, at least at the state level, I was one of the people who took advantage of particularly the phone technology right away and maximized that. I was one of, I remember a couple of years before I retired, we had switched over to a phone system at the university, which now sounds so archaic, but where you could change your voicemail message every day, press a couple of buttons, and at the end of whatever hour you designated, it would switch back to your normal generic. So I could leave a voicemail message that said, you know, this is Mary Carlson, what the date is, and this morning I will be in the Rutland office and I can be reached at such and such a number. I will be back in this office in such and such a time. And that was so helpful to people. It was especially helpful to know, or that my message might say, I think my regular message said, I am in the office today. If you leave a message, I can get back to you. And that meant so much to lay people out in the field. And it was amazing to me at the time how many people didn't take advantage of that. But that was a customer service, in my opinion. So that way I actually was much happier not having a paid staff person have to take a message for me. I got the messages exactly in their form and I accessed them from wherever I was. And again, this sounds so old-fashioned with the technologies that we have today. So there was that kind of change. Thank you, God. I had in high school taken a typing class, which for a person who was in the college prep program, that really was kind of, why are you bothering to do that? Well, when we were all more or less having to do our own entry keyboarding, I could do that. I wasn't having to hunt and peck. Those were differences. Kids changed, teenagers changed over those 34 years that I was there. And I would be the first to admit that working with the teenagers that I worked with, for the most part, they were teen leaders who worked on state committees, and they were the cream of the crop. You know, they had something invested. They weren't going to be the troublemakers. But and I retired in 2002, even at that time, it was becoming more challenging because there were more opportunities for them. They weren't into a lot of the techie stuff yet. It wasn't. Cell phones, kids didn't all have cell phones. They certainly didn't have texting and all of those kinds of things. But they had more opportunities for after-school activities at school. And so it became more and more challenging to find ways to hook them and have them want to be participating in our leadership activities, which I am absolutely convinced are so important. One of my concerns about young people today is that there are so many opportunities for them to be not together in groups, that they can do things independently, you know, be texting, be talking on the telephone, not having to interface with people. I think that can be a risk. And I'm happy that I had the opportunity to work when I did. Other major changes, and they came over time, was having fewer paid 4-H youth development professionals. When we went from county agents to regional specialists, and for a period of time had fairly few non-faculty 4-H youth development educators, that was a stressful time because there were fewer staff to do all the work that we had done before, and we hadn't really made this crossover to all the technology that we have now. For example, you didn't have electronic conference registration, so that kind of thing needed to be done with more paperwork, etc. That was a stressful time because we really needed to reinvent some of our models. But we did that. I want to go back to kids changing. I don't know if there's any more detail to give around that. We had gone to less and less of an agricultural society over that period of 34 years, but the program adjusted as well. We adjusted more to, of course, the 4-H Horse Youth Horse Program grew during that time period. And the Vermont 4-H Youth Development Program was wonderful in that that horse program developed from a model into a model that didn't require participants to have a horse. It was an educational program. And I was always so proud of that. And I really am out of touch with how it is today. But 4-H'ers participating in that program to go on to levels of competition beyond their local club and even beyond the county had to show evidence of participating in the 4-H program beyond showing a horse and winning a ribbon. And it didn't matter whether you had a backyard horse or a very, very expensive, well, highly bred horse. If you weren't participating as a 4-H'er in club activities, public speaking activities, leadership development activities, it didn't matter if you had the super duper animal that could win all of the ribbons. And I could take that to any national meeting and share that with great pride. And that, to me, has always been part of the 4-H youth development model in Vermont. I used to say that we promote kids with animals rather than animals with kids. And it was very similar in the dairy program, and as we developed the 4-H sheep program and any other livestock programs, we followed that same model. You had to have kept records and participated in the club level, at least at that time, in order to move on. And in some of the other states, that was just not the model. It was showing and competing and winning ribbons, and that definitely put the kids with more resources ahead of the children who didn't have resources. One of the other benefits of being in this state with a 4-H program was that we didn't have a lot of commodities pressure on us. Children from the Midwestern states and the Western states, where some of the commodity groups were so powerful, the beef commodity groups, the horse groups, the swine professional groups were so powerful. They really held a lot of pressure over the 4-H program. Well, Vermont was so small, and we didn't have pressures from those groups. We never had pressures from dairy groups that I remember. They really liked our anything that we did, to promote the development of young people working in those livestock industries, particularly in dairy, and I think now in sheep. And I'm unaware, of what we're doing with llamas or swine or those kind of things. That was an asset. And one of the strengths of being from a smaller state, and our development of being able to participate with animals, and I'm speaking often about animals here. There were certainly non-animal programs. Well, you didn't have to own; you could lease, etc. I
Is that
mean,
unique to Vermont?
you still can lease in other states, but it's, in my opinion, as highly as it was developed, was quite unique to Vermont. And again, it's because we're a small state. There were many benefits to being in a small state with the 4-H program because kids didn't get lost. Another place where it was really beneficial, way back, and I don't even know if this program still exists, but we had a program called National 4-H Congress, and it was funded completely by private dollars from industry and provided an all expense paid trip for children to this huge recognition event, which for the most part in those years was held in Chicago. And again, one of the benefits from being from a small state, our kids applied for those trips, and they had to do a written application, they had to have an interview, which were life skills, and they had to show evidence of having participated in this project and growing through the project, or a number of projects, over a period of years. So we might have, I remember the one year we had a girl who went in the fashion review project whose primary project had been a horse project. But as things sifted out, there was someone else who had a stronger record in the horse project, and she came up in the fashion review project. But what we were looking for was the well-rounded 4-H'er who could talk about their project work, who could interact with other young people, who could interact with industry representatives, who could interact with 4-H USDA representatives that would be there. Plus, if it were that we just picked the one person from the horse project, this person could have been left behind. It wasn't cutting out somebody else who had a stronger 4-H clothing fashion review experience. So that way we could spread the experiences to well-rounded 4-H'ers, to more of them. And so we would send a big delegation for us would be 20 4-H'ers. And some of the huge states would go with 50 delegates or 60 delegates. And partly because you were a bigger state. If you were a 4-H'er in California, your chances of going to National 4-H Congress as the fashion review delegate were one in a million. And here Vermont's got this fashion review delegate who would really rather be in the horse project area. But she was there. She was there, and she was able to have that experience. And I would say to them as we were prepping them to go, this is one of the things I want you to know. You could sit down. This was a joke that I used to tell the fashion review person especially. You could sit down at a table with people from McCall's and Simplicity and whatever companies, and you can have a delegate from, let's say, California or Texas in the fashion review that's going to have this story about how she made this three-piece all-wool suit from sheep that she had raised herself and designed the outfit, and she only has one arm. You know, she's going to have that kind of story. You are here because you have a well-rounded 4-H experience. You can talk about your clothing and your fashion review. You can also talk about the other projects. But we're sending you because you're representing our whole 4-H program, and you have this variety of experiences. So because initially they could just be floored by the stories from some of these other delegates. But that was I would say then, this is a value of being from a very small state. You don't have to be at all shy about your experiences. You're well-rounded. And they would come away 9 times out of 10 getting it. After they came back, they'd say, now we know what you mean, Mary, about that we could represent a variety of things. And I would also, this is kind of off the record, but I will also say to them, you're going to find out when you get there that you are not from a backwater area. I guarantee you are going to run into teenagers that are from backwater areas. You can be very proud of who you are and where you come from. So those are clearly benefits of being from a smaller state. Their chances were so much better of getting to where they go. It also helped them understand that it did help them understand this concept of you can't tell a book by its cover. In life, you're going to see these people who have won this and this and this. Now, certainly, that kid from California that was out there with a fashion review was super. Super. She probably had a semi-professional job modeling somewhere because of the size of the program. And your fashion review experience is very different, not nearly at the level of that one. So as you look at people in life that they all are lined up as winners or top-notch, you got to look beyond the front cover and find out what got them there. I think that was a learning experience for them.
are all sitting down at the table together, but you went through different steps. Some had more steps to go through than others. It doesn't make the ones who didn't go through so many steps any lesser. But don't just look at somebody and their title and get all gaga. I think one of the reasons that that was fun for kids was that it was planned by kids. And I felt very, very strongly about that. Way back when I first started my job, I got my job in early January of 68, and I was meeting with the State Day Teen Board in February, and I remember Polly Rowe saying to me, okay, we're going to be meeting with them tomorrow. Why don't you take over this part? And I was thinking, oh my gosh, I hadn't had any classes on how to do that. It was kind of sink or swim. But Teen Congress, it wasn't planned by adults. It was planned by teenagers, and the adults in charge who worked with them needed to be able to understand what the kids, what limits you could allow for the teens planning it, but do that in a way that it wasn't offensive to them. And that was something that I think I got a grip on. They needed to feel like they were valued, and what the suggestions they made were going to be respected and carried out, and that myself and whatever adults were working with them were not really going to try to one-up them. And that, to me, it was so gratifying to me to see young people coming onto that board as ninth graders, 13, maybe just about turning 14, and to watch them the next year on the committee and how much they had matured, and then see them after that coming, not as committee members, but coming to the event and seeing how they had grown, because many of them didn't have the opportunity for these kinds of experiences in many other places in their life. And to work with them through the various committee meetings and let them experience what it was like to make decisions. One of the key things that I knew was going to come every year was rules, dress codes, and girls and boys' rooms, and boys and girls' rooms, and discipline. And I always had to face that every year as if it was the first time I'd ever heard it. You know, and I knew in my heart this was going to come up. And to let them work that through. And the one year that the rule that they made was, there'll be no girls and boys' rooms and no boys and girls' rooms, even with the door open, and anybody that's caught doing that, they have to go home. I knew that wasn't going to work. And that happened. And two kids had to go home, of course. One was from Derby Line, and one was from Brattleboro. You know, they couldn't be from close by. And we analyzed that afterwards, and they said, this didn't work, did it? I said, no, it didn't work. We need to be more in the middle. But they figured out that that didn't work. But to then see them, to see so many of these were very rural kids, to have them be on the university campus was so exciting to them. To live in a dormitory was so exciting. Even in the lean years where we had a very small Congress, we would take advantage of that. We went to the movies. We didn't have enough budget to bring people in or to go on a cruise, but we would go to the movies. These kids didn't have an opportunity to go to a movie theater back in those years, or to go shopping at the University Mall. When our program grew again and we could do more exciting things, and where that got out of control with too many kids, we didn't do that. But always remembering that the bulk of our kids did not live in Chittenden County, and focusing on things that would be new and exciting to them, and giving them experiences that they didn't have in their own communities, taking advantage of the resources that were at the university for workshops or in the communities around, to me, was exciting. And then when you got to the event and had them, we always did things on a shoestring. So
the get acquainted activities, we couldn't afford to bring in a $1,000 key speaker. So they had to come up with their activities that they would do to get to know each other, you know, using balloons and cards and the game called Bring Me. They would be so excited about that. I had seen them all. I'd seen them all and participated in them all. But to remain key, my job was to keep that excitement. What a great idea. Let's do that. So they own the program. And in so few aspects of their life did they feel that they had ownership of something so far beyond themselves. Now, there were a couple of other things about this program. And I've had a recent experience where a now late 20-something has reinforced this with me. Teen Congress was a place where our 4-H teenagers could come and reinvent themselves. There was one person, and I won't even say male or female, but there was one teenager who came from a community in our state that was a prison community. There was a prison in that community. It was definitely a two sides of the track town. You came from the good side of the tracks, or you came from the not so good side of the tracks. In this person's community, this person was seen as coming from the not so good side of the tracks. However, that person was a musician, played in the school band, had great skills in the music arena, and could come to Teen Congress. Nobody knew that this was another side of the tracks kid in this kid's hometown. And that really helped set the life pattern for this person and helped build that person's self-esteem. I knew, because that kid's mother told me the situation. And that person went on to be quite successful. And there's another
yes,
instance where
I will
the person
talk about
was
kids.
And this is interesting. Don Waples had come from a strong 4-H family. His father had been the state 4-H leader in Connecticut. And Don bled green. And here I had come to 4-H via a definition from the Book of Knowledge. And although my commitment to 4-H just grew, in fact, having come from very rural central Maine, a really economically stressed area, 4-H would have been great for me at that time. And now there is 4-H happening as an afternoon school program, after school program in my hometown, which is even more economically stressed than it was. And I think, oh, thank you. That's exactly where they need to be. But anyway, Don bled green, and he loved camp. Thank you very much, because I went to camp once in my life. I went to a church camp in Maine when I was in eighth grade, and I was incredibly homesick. Rarely would I have to do anything with camping in Vermont. Once in a while, I would go to camp for some reason. As soon as I would start going down the camp road, especially downer, smell the pine trees, I just wanted to hurl. I would put on the face, and this is such a great experience, aren't you having a good time? And in the back of my mind, I would think, I wonder how many of these kids are really homesick. Ah, I just wanted to get out of there. But no one ever really knew that. I wasn't a camping person. So when Don retired and other people took over the camping responsibilities, I just said, this is not my thing. I can't do camping. But it was such an important, at that time, and great way of getting the 4-H methodology out to this other whole audience. I mean, it was a great way to do it. Now, the place where Don and I contrasted was he had no interest in international things. And again, I just stumbled on that because Polly Rowe had always done the 4-H international stuff. And as she approached retirement, you know, somebody needed to kind of take that over. And so I was the likely person. And once I started with that, I got hooked. I mean, it was something I really, really liked, and it still stays with me now. I found I could be very comfortable with internationals. One of the things that sometimes often stresses people out working with folks from other cultures is a language barrier.
And I never have been frightened by a language barrier. If we don't speak the same language, then I just carry a piece of paper and a pencil, and pictures do a lot. Body language does a lot. So that never bothered me. But Don wasn't interested in that. He didn't want to go out of the country. He was perfectly happy. It was a funny little story. Don and I shared the same office for a couple of years and in Morrill Hall. And it was quite a big office, and we had a partition between us, but it didn't go all the way to the ceiling, you know, one of those partial partitions. And his desk was on one side, and my desk was on the other side. And he was a person who worked with the foundation, and I happened to get a call from somebody who wanted to sell a product. It was somebody from Georgia, and it was from some Vidalia onion salt company. And I get this guy on the phone, and you know, "Mr. So-and-so from Georgia said I should call your office and talk about selling this Vidalia onion something or other." And I said, "Well, I'm not the person who works with the State 4-H Foundation. My colleague, Mr. Waples, who works with that, I'm not sure if he's in." So I'm walking around the corner with the phone going like this. "I'm not sure if he's in." And Don's going, no, waving his arms. And I said, "No, he's not in. I'll leave a message for him to get back to you." So I hung up the phone, and we, you know, smacked hands and said, "Ooh, got away from that one." And I can't remember another time I got a call from some colleague that I knew, and maybe it was from somebody in Washington, and they wanted to get this message out to everybody, all of our staff, blah, blah, blah. Whoever it was, I knew them quite well, and I said, "To tell you the honest truth, I could open up the window and yell this outside the window, and everybody that works for us would be able to hear it." You know, in some states, a Texas or a Michigan or a California, they had more people in a more staff in a corner of their state 4-H office than we had anywhere, you know, in our whole state. So that would be kind of fun. "Yeah, don't worry, I can get this message out pretty quick. I'll just open the window and yell." Don was a genius about some things. He had the skill for understanding that you needed. He was very committed to the 4-H club model as being the model, and I learned from him with this, being the model where you had educational experiences that built on each other over a period of time. Kids would start in a club model, and they would build on last year's experience for this year's experience and build and build. And that had a strength. However, he also appreciated that that was not the model for everyone, and that you could do the short-term model and impact children through the resident camp, through day camps. He was great with day camps, through special interest groups. And the other piece of genius that he had with that was there is always the pressure for numbers. You always need more numbers. And he would say, "Get the numbers with these short-term activities, and we do an educational process. And then we do what we really have our hearts in terms of the long-term educational model with the club method. We've got to have both of them. And the place where we really can do a lot with soft money is in the short-term models and try new things and experiment with new things." And as traditional as Don was, he was a genius, I always felt, with encapsulating that and being able to carry that off. He was also a very early pioneer with extension, especially with 4-H. He had come up from Washington County, he had come from a county model. And he had been very, very active with utilizing the work study program. That was how he had his additional staff, was working with the work study program. And when he came to the State 4-H office, we hadn't done that. And he made sure that we were active in utilizing those resources, which of course expanded our resources. He did a lot with day camps, and not only providing an educational service to
children in the summertime, kids who might not have that experience, who didn't have the resources, the economic resources to do that. But it brought us into working with communities, with rec departments, and reaching that new audience, some of which went on to become involved in the club model. But he was also a loose cannon sometimes, and he was very, very funny. But we made a pretty darn good team. In the last 10 or 15 years of my career, I would have been more aggressive in exploring grant monies, soft monies, to have diversified the program more. And that's kind of a catch-22, because our staff became so limited that it takes a certain amount of staff time to do that. But once you get past that curve, I think it would be possible. And I believe that's what is happening now. And I say this partly from my experience having been retired and really getting a grip on how valuable extension programs are to reaching people, and the 4-H program in particular. And part of this came with my working with refugees as a volunteer after I retired, and thinking, oh, so much of what these people need comes from an extension model. So I do look back and say, I really wish that I had been more aggressive with exploring new avenues, soft money, to have expanded the programs to wider audiences. And from my talks with 4-H staff now, I believe that more of that is happening. And that's really wonderful. I think that was, and we did need to move with the time. And again, I think the technology has done so much to make that possible. There are whole new, the avenues for delivering educational programs are so much different than even when I retired in 2002, that it opens up these doors. But we have 4-H is a wonderful delivery method for reaching young people and the parents of young people. And I do believe that we need to be continually expanding that base. The people who get those services, we need to continually be expanding that beyond our traditional audiences, not to leave the traditional audiences behind. The 4-H model has done so much to move this culture forward, but we do need to continually be cognizant of broadening, not leaving our traditional audience behind, but to expanding our methodologies to more of those. And that is one of the things that I wish I had been more more assertive with, but that I believe it's wonderful to have change. And I think having that change happen with the 4-H program has been great in that respect. And I'm very proud that extension and 4-H youth development have moved on in that respect.